Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
the 14th or 15th episode of Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen. There's been a gap of a day or so of my recordings. I've been doing various things. Obviously, during the day, it's either been sort of tropical rain or fairly heavy rain, or if it's not that, there's cicada build-up. And so in the early morning, or early, it's about 7:30-ish, 8 o'clock, there you go. Cicadas haven't really struck up yet, so I'll be able to read a little bit. And I've been working on various things, the Einstein pendulum, and which is the using the flip of the spin of electrons to actually rock a pendulum. It's working really rather well, but I'm trying to work out whether I'm actually making an elaborate compass. That is, creating a north pole and a south pole, and the Earth's magnetic field is it's finding its way around there. I'm looking at the geometry, I think it's not, I think it's a genuine experiment, but I still have to work on it. You can hear the birds at the back making it. Okay, now I just have to read. This is chapter 12, The Sun Dethroned. And of course, the overall objective of this, just to remind you, is cognitive therapy to be able to engage in different, more complex texts as they go along. And as usual, there's two quotes at the start. One is by Tommaso Campella, 1568 to 1639. I don't know if he's a quantum astronomer, I have to remember, or he's involved in that. And his grandmaster says this, "Grandmaster, oh, if you knew what our astrologers say of the coming age and of our age, that it is in more history within, that it is, has in it more history than within 100 years than all the world has had in 4,000 years before." Okay. And where that goes. Now, this is a Nazi slogan to be reworded by the German scientist Werner Heisenberg as, "We must make use of warfare for physics." And the Nazi slogan, it's a Nazi slogan, "We must make use of physics for warfare." The sun does not stand still, or even move in a simple pattern. At different times and under different examinations, there appears a solid orb, a ball of fire, a constantly discharging source of winds, flares, spirals, radioactive particles. Its latitudes rotate at different speeds, and its whole surface surges up and down by 4 kilometres every 160 minutes, although even to talk about the surface is a misleading, since being largely a collection of gases, it has none. Well, that's a new piece of information I've got, is that it surges up and down by 44 kilometres every 160 minutes. Well, that is a piece of information for me. Surface of the sun, actually, if they really technically want to go into, is up to the heliosphere, which is past Pluto. That's where the sun's rays go. And of course, the surface of the sun is just where it's been cooked down to. It's a cooked down point. We'll talk about that later if they get into it. I've got full confidence this book will possibly get into good physics. Seen from other planets, it is larger or smaller than when viewed from Earth. It has atmospheric effects, and its atmospheric effects are different on Mercury, say, than on the torrid mist of Venus, and different again on our planet. By the 18th century, astronomers had recognised that this was simply one star amongst many, just the one that happened to be nearest to us, and estimated its distance, size, mass, rotation and movement in space within 10% of today's value. But they continue to gnaw away at other problems. Okay. This is the sun dethroned. What was going on inside? What caused it to shine? How old was it? How did it relate to other heavenly bodies? Only now they were finding from many answers. Only now they were finding many answers. Between 1800 and 1950, aided and abetted by advanced technology and the Industrial Revolution and new enthusiasm from scientific inquiry, hardly a year went by without astronomers, physicists, chemists, geologists finding something to be added to our understanding. In just the first half of the 19th century, for example, absorption and solar line spectrums were mapped, electromagnetic induction and electromagnetic balance being discovered. both of which increase our knowledge of how the sun draws us to it. Okay. During the same period, the sun's energy output, the solar constant, was measured, leading to a greater appreciation of both the temperature and the influence on the climate. In 1860, the Vatican's chief astronomer photographed the eclipse of 18th of July, showing that the corona and prominences were real features, not optical illusions or deceiving illuminated mountains of the eclipsing moon. The list of specific discoveries run close to 200. In just a single decade, 1871 to 1880, for instance, came electromagnetic radiation, solar distillation of water, the sun purifier, the first radical re-estimate of the sun's age at 2 million years, and the length of time it would take to contract to its current size, both of which were off, were to touch off a major debate between scientists and literal interpreters of the variable. Other discoveries were less contentious. The sun's surface temperature was estimated at 5,430 degrees Celsius, while its core was reckoned to be gaseous, with temperatures steadily decreasing to the centre of the surface, which is not true. It goes up to 15 million degrees in the centre. Several new instruments, the heliospectroscope, the star spectroscope, the telespectroscope, were invented, and all fixed stars were found to display only a few combinations of spectra depending on their physical chemical nature. Achievement of great significance after Newton's law of gravitation, quotes someone. In recent years, the writer David Sorbell, Timothy Ferris, Bill Bryson, and as well as popularizing scientists like Carl Sagan, Stephen Hawking, have demystified such esoteric subjects as dark matter. Oh God, that's a mystery, isn't it? Dark, invisible but exercising attraction whose presence we infer from a gravitational pull through, we don't know what it is. Well, that's mysterious. And black holes, familiar but still difficultly to imagine. Well, not so much now. But what about deuterium, the ionosphere? Even the Coriolis effect, such words and phrases are part of the discourse that seem closed to most of us. That's beautiful. He's such a nice person. But two or three of the main strands of research can be braided together to show how, between 1800 and 1953, our knowledge of our feelings about the sun were transformed. Okay, so he's actually rather good. He's recognised as a person that we don't, if you said deuterium, you'd have a long time describe, it's this thing about the layperson is in a very low state of knowledge, but that fragmentary knowledge is what fragments they have are really important to how far you can get with them. And they, of course, have no feeling about that they should get anywhere. An ignorant person is ignorant of the ignorance, I think. Okay. Towards the middle of the 19th century, the French philosopher Auguste Comte was asked what would ever be forever impossible. He looked up at the stars. We may determine their forms, their distances, their bulk, their motions, but we can never know anything of their chemical or mineralogical structure, and much less that of the organized livings on their surface. Within a surprising few years, mankind would have grasped those very things. Okay. To put it in context, how quickly research expanded and focus shifted in 1800, only one stellar catalogue of precision was available. In 1801, J.J. Land published, describing 47,390 stars, which is sort of like the visible stars in the Milky Way. In 1814, Giuseppe Piazzi added another 7,600. Others followed between 1852 and 1859 alone. Some 342,000 were supplemented. Photographic charting began in 1885. By 1900, a third and concluding volume of the work appeared and located a massive 500,000 stars, the fruit of collaboration between scientists in Crocken, John Herschel, and Cape Town. It became abundantly clear the sun did not hang in the supreme object in the sky, but just one more star, an unspeakable one at that. Scientists would now concern themselves with a multitude of other suns far larger and heavier than ours. This a footnote. The first quarter of the 19th century, a German astronomer formulated Olbers' paradox. there were an infinite number of stars in the universe, there would be no night. The stars would be one huge glare, and we would be drowned in. Indeed, you could not have come into existence under such limited stellar energy. A good explanation is given in the 15-year-old Christopher Boone, an autistic boy and narrator of Mark Haydon's 2003 novel, The Curious Incidents of the Dog That in the Nighttime. I thought about how, for a long time, scientists were puzzled by the fact that the sky was so dark. Even though there are billions of stars in the universe, there must be stars in every direction you look. So the sky should be full of starlight because there is very little in the way to stop the light reaching Earth. Then they worked out the universe was expanding. The stars were all rushing away from one another after the Big Bang. And the further stars were away, the faster they were moving, some of them nearly the speed of light, which is why their light never reaches us. No, it's not the speed of light. It's not never reaches us. It redshifts. One should further add that no star shines for more than around 11 billion years. Well, that's one point, but also the fact that it's redshift. You missed that point. I don't think it's a really poor way that he's done. I don't think he understands redshift. So redshift, it's moving further away, the wavelength. So it is, we are drowned out, but the light is microwave light. Even this piece of knowledge was to be massively augmented in the pre-dawn hours of the 6th of October, 1923. The Mount Wilson Observatory, Edwin Hubble, was examining and photographed a fuzzy, spiral-shaped swarm of stars known as M31, or Andromeda. Here's an asterisk here. Certain objects have the letter M before them, designated numbers in honour of Charles Messier, a French astronomer who, in 1774, published a catalogue of 45 deep sky objects such as nebula, star clusters, to distinguish from comets. The final version of the catalogue was published in 1781, by which time it had grown to 103. So that's Messier. So it's a bulky thing. It could be a, so I suppose all M has to be specify galaxies. Hubble sat down and calculated the star was over 90,000 light years away. That is, he's Cepheids, and so this is Henrietta Lovett. See, it's amazing. My memory's coming back to the VC. So there's stars basically which digitally encode, you know, by ones and noughts, their intensity. Now, they pulsate. So the brighter they are, the faster they pulsate. So if they're pulsating brightly and far and dim, they're far away. So I wish you had that. Nearly three times the then estimated diameter of the entire universe. As the National Geographic reported the story, clearly this clump of stars resided far beyond the confines of the Milky Way. But Andromeda were separate galaxies, then maybe other nebulae in the sky of the galaxies as well. The known universe suddenly ballooned in size. Today we know there are at least 100 billion galaxies. I think there's 2 trillion galaxies now, you know? Now, each one harbouring a similarly enormous number of stars, about 2 trillion stars, a trillion stars on average. So there's a trillion trillion stars, that's a mind-boggling amount. So a trillion trillions of Yotto. So there's 2 Yotto stars amount. The Earth had already been devoted to the realisation that it circled the Sun, and not another way around. William Herschel and his son John, with their revolutionary telescopes, had revealed the riches beyond our solar system, and unwittingly devoted the Sun as well. There was a third or even fourth diminution that not only were we orbiting what was just a minor star among a multitude in the Milky Way, the Milky Way was itself one galaxy of untold number. Okay, the untold number we're talking about. As today, solar scientist Stein Oswald admits, hardly any astronomer I know really enjoys space physics of the kind involved in studying this Earth-Sun system. The excitement of exploring how stars evolve, the structure and contents of the universe, was much more potent draw of attention and enthusiasm. Solar space research was often seen too local. It was intellectually a very messy physics to boot. It is actually quite very messy, physics, alpha and waves and stuff like that. But yeah, I'll have to really get this all in my head. For scientists, solar astronomy was the future. Minor stars need not apply. A.E. Halsman, poet and classicist, also a keen student of astronomy, certainly observed, we found ourselves in smaller patrimony, or whatever that means. The displacement was occurring alongside centuries-long, frequently vehemently argument over the age of the Earth, and thus the age of both the Sun and the universe, an issue that provoked intense interest amongst astronomers, but theologians, biologists, and geologists. Date of creation had been made particularly exact by the elderly Irish Protestant Archbishop James Ussher, 1581 to 1656, who took the begats in Genesis and the floating chronology of the Old Testament, and with a little helpful tweaking from the Middle East and the Mediterranean histories, not least the Jewish calendar, which lays down the creation fell on Sunday the 23rd of October, 3760 BC. Arrived at a conveniently round figure of 4,000 years between creation and most likely the birth date of Christ in 4 BC. Were it not for the London bookseller Thomas Guy, Ussher's dating might have sunk into obscurity. This is amazing. I wish it happened. As those who, and see, he's a publisher, isn't he? Those who had hundreds or so biblical chronologists before him. By law, the only certain publishers, such as Cambridge and Oxford University Press, were allowed to print the Bible. Guy acquired a sublicense to do so, and in a moment of marketing inspiration, printed Ussher's chronology in the margins of his books, along with engravings of bare-breasted women loosely linked to the Bible stories. Wow, these are beautiful. He's a publisher, and he's got these two publishing. One is the Arabs stuff, and this is Ussher's, was someone trying to pass off a porn Bible. What a porn Bible, isn't it incredible? The edition earned Guy a fortune, enough to endow the great London hospital that bears his name. What is it? If this were not enough, in 1701, the Church of England authorised Ussher's chronology to appear in an official version of the King James Version, and received a chronology that soon became an automatic presence that was printed well into the 20th century. As the historian Martin Gost puts it, the influence of this date was enormous. For nearly 200 years, it was widely accepted as the true age of the world. It was printed in Bibles, copied into various almanacs, and spread across the missionaries in four corners of the world. The universe was dominated by Western thought until the time of Darwin, and even then it lingered on. Gorse recalls coming across his grandmother's 1901 Bible and finding a set opposite opening verse of the Genesis date. The world began at 6 p.m., 9 p.m., 6 p.m. on Sunday, the 22nd of October, 404 BC. Wow, isn't that incredible? But this is the entire thing, a porn Bible. This is the most incredible thing I've ever seen. As recently as 1999, the Gallup poll reported that 47% of Americans believe God created the human race within the last 10,000 years. Stephen Hawking notes in A Brief History of Time that the date of 10,000 years fits curiously well with the end of the last ice age, which, when archaeologists tell us civilization really began. I don't know whatever that means. So, finishing this. Even Zazra's time, however, freethinkers began to question the accepted chronology. Travellers among the far-off lands with reports of histories that went well back to further than 404 BC, with the event of new forms of inquiry based on scientific principles. Nullus in verba, nobody likes the word for it, runs the motto of Britain's Royal Society. It came to, in the turn of natural philosophers to debate the age of the globe. In 1681, a fellow Don at Newton's Cambridge, Thomas Burnett, published the best-selling Sacred Theory of the Earth, which argued that the world's great mountain ranges, the vast oranges, had been shaped by the flood of Genesis. He got around the Old Testament statement that the creation had taken 6 days by quoting St. Peter's pronouncement that one day is the Lord as 1,000 years. A shelf of books appeared offering similar explanations. Then, later the same decade, two British naturalists, John Ray and Edward Lurden, after examining shells of the Welsh Valley and Antilles on the northeast English coast, concluded that both groups of fossils came from species that would have been needed far more than 5,680 odd years to live and die out in such numbers. Their researchers aroused a short-lived flurry of interest, followed by a period of neglect until the London physician John Woodward, 1665 to 1728, posited that the fossils were spores of a once living animals and had perished in the flood. But this theory, too, met with ridicule. Faith in Usher's chronology endured. It was Edmund Halley, in 1751, came the first person to suggest careful observation of the natural world, such as measuring the salinity of oceans, would provide clues to the Earth's age. His ideas were eagerly adopted by George Louis de Buffon in 1707 to 88, which is Histoire Naturelle. He argued the Earth was tens of thousands of years old, the idea that dazzled the French public with a timescale so vast they could barely comprehend its enormity. While Buffon did not sample the oceans, he did believe the Earth began not in a biblical single moment in the past, but a result of a comet colliding with the sun, the debris of the explosion coalescing to form the planets. Referrals simply ignored the biblical account of creation, possibly encouraged by the appearance in 1770 of the first printed blunt denial of any divine purpose, Système de la Nature, by the 47-year-old French philosopher Paul-Henri Dietrich d'Holbach. Theologians at the Sorbonne erupted in fury. Buffon was forced to publish retraction, privately declaring, "Better be humble than hanged." He was going to be executed, wasn't he? He would not be kept quite long when another Frenchman, mathematician Jean-Jacques Dautres de Matin, demonstrated the Earth did not get its heat from the sun alone, but it contained it in its source. Buffon was galvanized into writing a history of the world from its inception. If the Earth is still cooling, then find the rate at which it lost one calculated age. Over the next years, he concluded the series of experiments ultimately concluded the Earth was 4,000 years old, a figure believed highly conservative. His unofficial estimate was 100,000. His book was met with a chorus of disbelief. In 1788, he died, and the following year, the revolution erupted. Buffon's crypt was broken into, and the electrical coffin relinquished to make bullets. Isn't that beautiful? Undaunted, the intellectually curious continued to search for the explanation for all they found on Earth. And by the 19th century, the division between church and science was greater than ever. Between 1800 and 1840, the word geology, biology, scientists were either coined or acquired specialized senses of vernacular. Now, it's interesting that scientist scientist came in 1836 as a term. And geology in particular was popular. Soon scientists and others identifying and naming successive layers of strata. In Byron's phrase, thrown topsy-turvy, twisted, crisps and curled that formed the Earth's surface. A shy young British barrister named Charles Lyell, building on John Woodward's example, used fossil measures of the Earth's age, finding them in lava remains in Sicily and estimated them to be 100,000 years old. By 1840, the evidence of the Earth was exceedingly ancient was overwhelming. Even if man had been around for 6,000 years, prehistoric time had expanded beyond comprehension. Then, in 1859, came the Origin of Species, the great argument, or it's hard to say, species, and the great argument of man's evolution of apes determined reading of the Bible. Dr. Usher's, that really doesn't capture the slow birth of it. Dr. Usher's reckoning was at last no longer feasible. Cambridge University removed his chronology from the Bible since 1900. Oxford followed in 1910. By then, Mark Twain had already imagined the Eiffel Tower as representing the age of the world. He likened our share of the age to the skin of paint on the knob of the pinnacle. That's beautiful. Good on you, Mark Twain. Mighty doctrines then opened up amazing perspective. When scientists extended the age of the Earth to over 100,000 years, an array of new ideas emerged. The age to give us, what age now to give the sun? After Darwin, scientists had to consider that had been releasing its energy over millions of years. Natural selection required the solar system to be previously inconceivable age. And it is only because the sun is not particularly powerful and burns relatively slowly, being tolerant to the sensitive carbon-based compounds that are basis of earthly life, that evolution, not that Darwin ever liked that word, did occur. Although the argument about the Earth's age rumbled through the later decades of the 19th century, questions about the star were drawing more attention from scientists. As Timothy Ferris puts it, the titans of physics chose to focus less on Earth than that suitably grander, more luminous body. The noted German physicist Hermann von Helmholtz tried to explain that the sun drew its power, and 1854 came up with the idea that just like other stars, it must steadily be contracting under its own gravity, so creating energy by the very compression. However, although Helmholtz's theory might apply to a degree, such a method would only enable the sun to shine at its present rate for a few million years, consequently had to be powered by another way. In the summer of 1899, a professor of geology at the University of Chicago, Thomas Chamberlain, published a paper on how the sun was fuel changed one of the most basic assumptions in astrophysics. Its presence knowledge relative to the behaviour of matter under extraordinary conditions to retain the interior of the sun sufficiently exhaustive to warrant the assertion that no unrecognised source of heat resides there. What the internal constitution of the atoms may be as yet an open question, it is improbable that they are complex organisations that seek enormous energies. What does that mean? Within 5 years, the central principles of physics, the consequently the basis of assumptions about the function of the sun, had been remade. In the spring of 18... I still don't know atomic physics today. Nuclear physics. Nuclear physics. In the spring of 1896, Henry Brackwell, a Paris physicist, inadvertently saw some unexposed photographic plates wrapped in black paper beneath a lump of uranium ore he had been using for an experiment. Now, his experiment was he was looking at whether the ore was absorbing sunlight. And so it was inclement weather, so he just put his uranium away for a while. So he was going out and seeing whether it was being charged up by the sun. Uranium, named after the planet in 1789, is the most complex atom regularly formed by nature, composed primarily of uranium-238, as will be discovered, composed of 92 protons and 146 neutrons, plus a small percentage of less stable 235-3 neutrons less. Okay, now what I was going to say is that you've got various elements. So you've got selenium, the moon, tellurium, the sun, palladium, Pallas, cerium, Ceres, and then helium, the sun, obviously, back down there, and then you've got uranium, Neptune, Pluto, plutonium. Okay. When after a few weeks, he developed the plates, he found that they had been exposed to light, for they had been imprinted with an image of a silvery white mineral, which he thought must be emitting a type of invisible phosphorescence. Marie and Pierre Curie, following up on this lucky discovery, would later name the phosphorescence radioactivity. The most extraordinary aspect was the uranium radiated heat without cooling down to the temperature of its surrounding. But the metal was not easy to obtain, nor was the radiation it produced particularly impressive, so the Curie's findings were generally ignored. Then, in 1898, they discovered pitchblende, another uranium ore, emitted much greater amounts of radioactivity than other sources of the metal. It was possible that there were elements on Earth that were releasing tremendous amounts of unseen energy waiting to be tapped. I hope he goes this right. Soon, the further rarer element, named radium, that Curie's had extracted from pitchblende, was being written up in mainstream papers as the miracle metal, the most valuable metal known to man, capable of curing blindness, revealing the sex of the fetus, and even turning the skin of a black man white. A single gram would lift 500 tons a mile in height, and an ounce would drive a car around the world. Advertisements promoted its use as a radioactive drinking water for treatment of gout, rheumatism, arthritis, diabetes, and a range of other afflictions. People demonstrated radium at parties and went to radium dances, while the word became fashionable. Brand name radium beer, radium butter, radium chocolate, radium condom, radium condoms, radium suppositories, and even radium contraceptive jelly. In 1904, scientists were also claiming radium was the source of energy of the sun. The question was whether the energy was coming from within the atoms of uranium or from outside. The great physicist Ernest Rutherford, a New Zealander who had worked on the nature of atoms. Now, Marie Curie believed that there was energy in the world and radium was just an antenna. She was just wacko. Unfortunately, she was just insane. I'll have to read the history of Marie Curie. Both England and Canada began to explore the atomic link, combining the forces of the Canada-based English chemistry, Frederick radium, Rutherford had established, generates enough heat to melt the weight of ice, its weight in ice, every hour, and will continue to do so for millennia more. The Earth stays warm, not least because it's heated by radioactive decay of rocks in the molten core that lies in the centre. This is actually true. Most of the planet's internal heat is generated by four long-lived radioisotopes. Potassium-40, which is the source of all our argon, potassium-40 decays into argon. Thorium-232, uranium-235 and 238. Okay. The roots of energy over billions of years as they decay into stable isotopes of other elements. The Earth's core is hot, dense, spinning solid sphere composed primarily of iron, some nickel. Diameter is 2,400 kilometres, so 90% of the Earth's radius, which is 4 pi, 12,740 kilometres, surrounding a liquid layer of 2,200 kilometres thick. 85% iron heat-induced rolling creates the Earth's magnetic field. The two cores together comprise of 1/8 of the Earth's volume, but 1/3 of its mass. Over a period of 700 to 1,020 years, the inner core will make one full spin more than the rest of the planet, intensifying the Earth's magnetic field. Can I say, we don't know whether that is the source of the magnetic field, to be quite honest, but this is what a brilliant book. What an absolute brilliant book here. And being a publisher, being able to see the publisher's contribution. This is a true contribution, that the publication of Usher's pornographic Bible. Just a genius. The two men were soon experimenting with thorium, a radioactive element not unlike uranium, and found that independently yielded a radioactive gas, one element transmuting another. The result was so startling that Soddy told Rutherford about the finding. The New Zealander shouted back across the lab floor, "Don't call it transmutation, they'll have our heads off as alchemists." They proceeded to prove that the heavy atoms of thorium, radium and other elements they discovered to be radioactive broke down to atoms of lighter elements in the form of gases. And they did so, which is helium gases, a radioactive throw-off. What if he says that? They threw off minute particles, which they dubbed alpha and beta rays, actually elements' main output of energy. Further experiments by Rutherford showed that most of the atoms' mass lay in its core, surrounded by a crackling web of electrons. Oh, that's the worst thing. So I'm a quantum physicist. That crackling web of electrons just makes me vomit. He and Soddy speculated that radioactivity of the same kind could be powering the sun. While their work had considered worthy of further investigation, it was not seen as astrophysically revolutionary. Some 40 years later, Robert Jung would write his groundbreaking account, Brighter Than a Thousand Stars. Professor Rutherford's outer particles ought really at the time to have upset not only the atoms of nitrogen, but also the peace of mind of humanity. They ought to have revived dread, the end of the world, forgotten for many centuries. But in those days, all such discoveries seemed to have little to do with the realities of life. Okay, so this is vitamin. Isn't it amazing? 40 years from I'm holding up a test tube at a party. It's glowing. I've got, look at my photographic plate. It's something's weird, and then poor people in Hiroshima getting the bejesus blown out of them. It's just incomprehensible. You know, the people would learn to fly, and computers and radio waves are just. During the last years of the First World War, Rutherford failed to attend a meeting of experts who were to advise the High Command on new systems of defence against enemy submarines. When censured, he retorted, "I have been engaged in experiments which suggest that the atom can artificially disintegrate. If it's true, it's of far greater importance than the war." Isn't that beautiful? Okay. Subject is best to explain discovery. First, interpretations of radium 1912 and interpretations of the atom 1932, arguing that before atomic decay was known, the only explanations of sun energy output would have been chemical, and thus short-term and puny. But once we had learned about radioactivity, the storm of subatomic reactions revealed themselves. There was something like the right scale to power the sun. Nearly a decade passed before anyone built on Soddy's and Rutherford's discoveries. Eddington, fresh from its successes off the coast of Africa, now conducted a wide-ranging study of the energy of pressure equilibrium of stars and went so far as to construct mathematical models of the temperature and density. What is possible in the Cavendish laboratory, he famously commented, may not be too difficult in the sun. He estimated the sun has a central temperature of 4 million degrees. It's actually 5 million. And argued that there must be a simple relationship between the total rate of energy loss in the sun and its luminosity of mass. Once he knew the sun's mass, he reckoned he could predict its luminosity. It's actually true, the mass and luminosity are linked in a strange way. To the ancients, it seemed obvious that the sun was fire, but to the late 19th century, early 20th century physicists, that was unacceptable. It was just too hot to be chemically burning. So the question remained, as John Herschel put in his great mystery was, quote, to conceive how so enormous the conflagration, if such it be, can be kept up. Every discovery in chemical science there leaves us completely at a loss, or rather it seems to remove further the prospect of probable explanation. If conjecture might be hazarded, we should look rather to the known possibility of indefined generation of heat by friction, or to the excitement by electric charge, or the origin of solar radiation. I don't know what that means. Okay. Since the research of the Earth's age was now suggesting it was more than 2 million years old, the sun must have been shining for at least that length of time. What processes could possibly account for such startling output of energy? The Uranian-born American physicist George Gamow, or G, put it, if the sun were made of pure coal and had been set afire at the time of the first pharaohs in Egypt, it would now be completely burnt to ashes. The same inaccuracy applies to any other kind of chemical transformation. That might be offered as explanation. None of them could account for even a 100,000th part of the sun's life. Cosmologists looked at Gamow's fellow astrophysicists for answers. After anything offered to, the first was that the electrons and protons having opposite electric charge annihilated each other within the sun's core, with the culminant conversion of matter into energy. About a year later, he advanced, secondly, the correct solution. The sun was fusing protons to heavier atoms, process converting the mass into energy. But how could such fusion take place in the sun's consuming heat? A feature of these years was many vital discoveries were made by outsiders, scientists whom no one regarded as solar physicists before their contribution to the field. Eddington had a young disciple, Cecilia Payne. Oh, she died in 1980. Had been 5 years old when she saw a meteor and decided to become an astronomer. Oh, isn't that beautiful? Following university, she was introduced to Eddington, who advised her to continue her studies in America. She became the first student, female or male, to earn a doctorate in the Harvard College Observatory. Examiners judged her 1925 thesis, a photographic study of variable stars, the best ever written in astronomy. What? So what is Cecilia Payne doing with Cepheids? There's another. So what is? I don't understand. Cecilia Payne, Cepheids. Now what's that? Yeah, the memory's gone. Come back to me at some stage. The Harvard computer. The Henrietta Lovett. There you go. Unfortunately, you can see my memory is just not there. So what if I can say? There's conscious bit where I used to be able to fight my memory and gate, pull that piece of information out. It's just not there anymore. And so this thing, so Henrietta, how does Henrietta Lovett fit into that? Her solution to the temperature problem was to use Rutherford's discoveries of atomic structure to show that all stars have the same chemical makeup. Where their spectra differed, it was physical conditions, not their innate composition. Hydrogen and helium were far more abundant in the sun's 57 known elements as they were in other stars. Despite this conclusion, her final list of chemical elements in the sun, she omitted hydrogen and helium, branding her own argument as spurious. It later transpired that her supervisor, renowned Princeton astronomer Henry Norris Rutherford, had tried to talk her out of her theory. It is bloody hell. It's clearly impossible for hydrogen should be a million times more abundant than the other metals that he worked on, reaching the conventional wisdom. But Payne's arguments nagged at him. He realised the sun's absorption spectrum and finally accepted that she was right. Giant stars, indeed, had an outer atmosphere of nearly pure hydrogen, with hardly more than a smell of metallic vapours in them. Stars fused hydrogen into helium, releasing continuous blasts of energy. And when the sun's great energy was generated by the transformation of chemical elements taking place in the interior, as Gamma's implied, impishly noted, what was happening was precisely the transformation of elements that had been so unsuccessfully pursued by alchemists of old. In principle, the burning of hydrogen into helium would allow the sun to shine for 100 billion years. That's quite correct. But then we've got the... CNO cycle, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen cycle. The next step was to understand nuclear fusion. In the late 1920s and 1930s, witnessed a shift of research from the atomic nucleus. One particular centre of the Institute of Theoretical Physics at Copenhagen University directed the estimable Niels Bohr, who dressed like a banker and mumbled like an oracle. Now, this is the entire thing. Niels Bohr is the most outlandish jerk, I know, so I really dislike him. By the 1920s, Bohr had attained international stature, able to attract many great physicists of the day, including George Gamow. The unremarkable Ukrainian had a reputation both for scientific innovation and for playfulness. He would illustrate his scientific papers with drawings of a skull and crossbones to indicate the danger of accepting hypotheses about fundamental particles at face value. In 1928, he showed how precisely charged helium nucleus, the alpha particle, had been emitted in such great numbers by the sun, could escape from the nucleus of a particular metal found on Earth, uranium, despite binding electrical forces within the metal. Okay, whatever that means. Okay. The great spirit of Copenhagen Hot House can be gleaned from the chip of several scientists made to the cinema in 1828. After seeing a Western, Bohr contended that he knew why the hero always won the gunfight provoked by the villain. Reaching the decision by free will always takes longer than reacting instinctively. So the villain, who thought of the kill in cold blood, acted more solid than the hero, who reacted spontaneously. To test his scientific manner, Bohr and his band of fellow researchers sought out the nearest toy shop and bought toy guns, which was... Showdown was duly enacted. Bohr taking the role of a hero, and the 6-foot-4 Gamma, the villain. And Bohr's theory was judged correct. Oh dear. Well, it's hard to do. Gamma, that's interesting. There was a bit more to it. Gamma now showed how alpha particles broke out of the nuclei, but he went on. Not only he went on to show how they could break in. at Cambridge, two of his colleagues, John Cockcroft and Ernest Watson, said about applying gamma theory to testing whether very high voltages could propel particles through the outer walls of the nucleus. In 1932, they succeeded. For the first time, the nucleus of one element was broken down into another element by artificial means. The feat became known as splitting the atom. In the same year of miracles, another Cambridge man, James Chadwick, discovered the neutron, the common form of the particle living inside the virtually all nuclei. Now, what I was going to say is that Marie Curie's daughter had discovered the neutron, but Marie Curie, complete whack, told her not to bother. Suddenly, a whole variety of powerful reactions could be detected and even induced in the subatomic world. What was now obvious was how such discoveries bore out in Paine's view that these were the reactions powering the sun. The high tide of crucial new work roared on. In 1934, the French physicist Frédéric Joliot and his wife Irene Curie, the daughter of Pierre and Marie, proved by bombarding stable elements with ultraviolet, a new kind of reactivity could be affected. A few years later, the Italian physicist Enrico Fermi bombarded uranium with neutrons and reported similar results. I wonder if they do have Fermi's great tabletop experiment. In 1939, Hans Berth, the great German-American atomic physicist, originally from Strasbourg, but this time at Cornell, wrote a series of articles culminating energy production of stars. He explains how stars, including the sun, managed to burn really in years. He had been cataloguing the subatomic reactions that had been identified to date. Up until 1932, these had only been a fistful. Suddenly, they became a landslide. You can now see which particular ones explain the sun's working. He posited that the abundance of energy was the result of a sequence of six nuclear responses, and it was a process that lit all stars. Simply put, the sun was formerly known as a nuclear reactor. The same year, German physicists Otto Hahn and Fritz Strassmann demonstrated what Fermi had witnessed in 1934 was actually a bursting of uranium nucleus. See, it's a bit of a jerk, Fermi. Two of their colleagues, Lietz Mitya, and so now there's Mitya is a element is named after this one. So there's curium and mitrium, but I'm gonna have to get my German friend to pronounce it. How do you pronounce mitrium? Mitrium is it? Chemical element Mt, I think it is. Went further, showing that when uranium atoms split, an enormous amount of energy is released. Frisch asked biologist colleague for a word to describe the bacterium dividing in two, and was told fission. It was the splitting of the atom that required this name. Hungarian Vera Salazar was the next to make his mark. Although even Einstein believed that the atomic bomb was impossible, as the energy released by seeing nucleus was so insignificant, Salazar, spurred on by memories of reading H.G. Wells' novel The World Set Free, which predicted such a weapon, confirmed. It's interesting that the atomic bomb was predicted by Wells. This is amazing. Creating possibility of a chain reaction where fissions were set off further fission. And I still conceive one dull September morning in 1933 waiting for the red light in London's Bloomsbury. So the energy splitting of a single uranium nucleus could be multiplied by many trillions, releasing energy exponentially. And not only was fission possible, it could be produced at will. A pinned at the Cambridge scientist C.P. Snow. With the discovery of fission, physicists became, almost overnight, the most important military resource of nation-state to call upon. By the advent of the Second World War, both Allied and Axis scientists were keenly aware that nuclear fission might be converted into some kind of weapon, although no one was sure how. Salazar, in fact, was involved in Einstein in creating a fridge. Now, he may know all about the publishing of the pornographic Bible, Usher's pornographic Bible with nude women in it. So up there. So there's various birds here. But I know about the fridge.
With the war underway, one of the routine duties of R.V. Jones, scientific advisor to the MI6, was to read through the monthly summaries of German scientific publications. Early in 42, he pursued the latest report, and next minute he was running like a lamplighter down a corridor. German nuclear physicists have stopped publishing. The war cabinet met within an hour. So, isn't that incredible? Isn't it incredible? It's another publisher view. This is good. So they would know the same. By the event of the Second World War, Allied, I say, still highly skeptical, Einstein declared that the challenge included the chain reaction. Making fusion bomb was akin to going to shoot birds at night in the land where there were very few birds, but secretly, we're going to shoot birds at night and very few birds. I love it. Where did he say that? Who did Einstein say that? Isn't that beautiful? They're really big challenges. But secretly, in a letter to Roosevelt dated 2nd of August 39, drafted along with his friend Leo Szilard, he urged the funds to develop fission-based weapons. A single bomb of this type, carried by a bomb exploded in a port, might very well destroy the whole port together with some of the surrounding territory. What I was going to say is that they had the Halifax bombing. I hope that we might mention that. So Halifax in World War One, there was a TNT ship which went kaboom and blew up Halifax. Now, interesting, Halifax in World War One was not part of Canada. Canada only formed after World War Two. It was two separate countries, British dominions. There was the British Dominion of Canada and France. Much alarmed by this letter, in the autumn, much alarmed by this letter, Roosevelt earmarked a small amount of money for the study of fission. Small because it was assumed that any bomb would require so many tons of uranium that it would be theoretically possible, but probably not practical option. However, in 1942, German refugees from Britain, Otto Fisch and Rudolf Pierce, calculated that only a few pounds of isotope 235 were required. Other scientists in Britain conceived a gaseous diffusion technique, and put together these two advances galvanized the government to lobby the United States-based research to be shifted to more professional hands, more effectively financed. Well, this is a major thing. This is a major, major difference. Okay, I didn't know that. You typically saw Einstein's letter, the Manhattan Project. No, Einstein's letter, a courtesy, and then the courtesy. Say, this is interesting. The Americans listened. In 1942, Brigadier General Leslie Groves Jr. took over what became known as the Manhattan Project, guided by solar physicist John Robert Oppenheimer. Groves brought together top nuclear scientists of the day, supported by unprecedented funding and manpower. The project took over 30 sites across the US and Canada, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, several in central Manhattan, Chalk River, Ontario. So there's still a Chalk River reactor in Ontario. Richland, Washington, and its headquarters of the Thelma was the Cottonwoods. A small school on a ranch near Santa Fe, New Mexico. At its peak, the project employed more than 130,000 people, most of whom had no idea that they were working. But it was still far from inevitable that the United States would become the first in the century to build a bomb. On the eve of the Second World War, Germany was at least as far advanced in nuclear physics and had plentiful supplies of uranium, which is what was put out in the letter. When the nucleus of uranium-235 absorbs a neutron, it splits into atoms of strontium and xenon, or various things. And xenon-135 is a neutron poison. So often your bomb pauses for a while, go put, and then boom. And this is the 2-3, the xenon buildup of 125 xenon, is the thing responsible for the Chernobyl reaction. Okay, the bomb. Here you go. Raw uranium dug up from the ground contains less than 1% 235. A bomb needs about 80% pure 235, otherwise uranium 238 blocks the chain reaction. Scientists at the Manhattan Project problem was how to separate the two. The breakthrough came at Oak Ridge by a series of racetracks. Really huge belts of silver magnets were devised to pull gaseous uranium through vacuum tubes, separating the weapons scrub 235 from heavier bionic siblings. So they required to get the magnetic field up, silver, and so all throughout the Commonwealth and the West, silver was sourced from Argentina, Australia, and stuff like that. And there was some still sitting around from the Manhattan Project in Adelaide universities, these crates of silver bullion, which the university took and cashed in many years later because they didn't work out where it's from. So lots of interesting things happening on. But I don't think they use that. I think they use gas centrifuges. You used to walk on a wooden walkways and feel the magnets pulling your nails in your boots, the scientists used to call. Yes. On one occasion, a man carrying a sheet of metal walked too close to a racetrack and found himself stuck to the wall. Everyone yelled for the machines to be shut down. Since it would have taken nearly a day or more to restart everything, the engineer in charge refused. Instead, the unfortunate man had to be prized off with 2x4s. Early labs were hardly sophisticated places. A stray radiation induced by radioactivity in everything from gold teeth and zippers and trouser flies. A proportion of those who worked in the Manhattan Project died in suspiciously early days. Yes. I'm just trying to think of some of the madcap dangerous things. Which is in my head. Oh, here's a picture of an atomic bomb. I just have to really concentrate. I'll continue reading just my head's running out of a bit of brain power. When the Third Reich surrendered in the 8th of May 1945, the Manhattan Project was months away from a weapon. To hasten the victory in the Pacific, Oppenheimer decided to conduct a test. On 16th of July, in a desert north of Amarillo, New Mexico, released the equivalent of 19 kilotons of TNT. Ah, that's right, yeah, okay. Far mightier than any previous man-made explosion. The news rushed to Truman, who tried to use it to leverage Stalin and the Potsdam Conference to no avail. After listening to arguments for his scientific and military advisors and hoping to avoid invasion, calculated to extract millions, a million and a quarter Allied dead, nearly double the British United States fatality for the whole war up to that point. Truman ordered the weapon to be used against Japanese cities on the 6th of August, a uranium-based bomb called Little Boy dropped on Hiroshima. And 3 days later, the fat man loosed in Nagasaki, which is a plutonium bomb. And so plutonium was much... I think Hiroshima was 64 kilograms of uranium, whereas it was only 6.4 kilograms of fat man, which is plutonium. So plutonium is far better. Okay. Now, in May 1946, the New Yorker sent Japanese-speaking journalist John Hershey to write an extended account of what had performed. His 30,000-word report took up a whole of the 31st August issue. No cartoons, verse, or shopping notes, which sold within hours. One haunted subscriber had pre-ordered 1,000 copies. Albert Einstein. Wow. Isn't that incredible? So that's a beautiful thing. This is the publishing thing. This is a publishing notes. This is really, publishing is really so important in the world. Okay. 3 days later, okay. The bright light hit us at the top of the mushroom cloud. Lit up at the top of the mushroom cloud. It was the most terrifying, but the most beautiful thing you'd ever seen in your life. Every colour of the rainbow seemed to come out of it. The bomb kills 100,000 people outright and another 180,000 dying later of burns, radiation sickness, and related cancers. The drunken age had begun. Hans Berth, a gas, devoted the rest of his life to checking the weapon's own impulse, as he put it. Like others who had worked on the atomic bomb, I was exhilarated by our success and terrified by the event. Winston Churchill told the House of Commons,
that he wondered whether giving such power to the man was a sign God had wearied of his creation. "I feel we have blood on our hands," Oppenheimer told Truman, replied, "Never mind, it'll come out in the wash." On the 23rd of December 1949, the Soviet Union tested the first nuclear device, a fission bomb. The amount of energy practically released by the fission, by fission bombs, atomic bombs, and A-bombs, which produce their destructive force to the fission alone, ranges between less than a ton and around half a megaton. The other, vastly more powerful category of bomb to obtain energy by fusion, oh, here we go to the end, light elements, not necessarily hydrogen, into slightly heavier ones, the same process as far as stars. Duplicate this and one can make weapons of almost limitless power, known variously as hydrogen bomb, H-bomb, thermonuclear bomb, and fusion bomb. The loop identity of fusion bomb is a specially manufactured compartment adjacent to fusion fuel. The gamma rays and X-rays emitted by the explosion compress the heat capsule of tritium, deuterium, and lithium deuteride, initiating a fusion reaction. Now, that's right. But there was the very first bomb was with actually built an atomic bomb around the outside of a deuterium bottle, and that blew up like incredibly much. That was a huge bomb. So that's basically built a factory. And okay, in 1952, a blinding flash of light from the explosion the US set off in the small island of the Pacific signaled the detonation of the first hydrogen bomb. For a split second, the energy had existed only at the center of the sun and leached on the mountain Earth. Its intense debate that followed, some scientists such as theoretical anti-communist Edward Teller, who had originally, so Teller just worked anti-communist in 1952, built as a bomb, and the bomb is the most insane. The first bomb they built was insane. Who originally posited such a bomb argued that nuclear power was a good thing, that research could continue. Others, Oppenheimer, Einstein, Berth, amongst them, felt that their dreams for what physicists might have accomplished had turned into a darkness and blood. What went almost unnoticed was that the splitting of the atom heralded yet one more demonstration, the motion of the sun. The other world, the energy, was no longer unique. Bohr exclaims to Werner Heisenberg in Michael Finian's play Copenhagen, "You see what we did? We put man back in the center of the universe." Isn't that beautiful? Okay, I'm going to put this across. Okay, so I'll put this up for publication. Thanks a lot for listening. The publisher's view is just, what a fantastic view. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.